In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Keeping an eye on big government.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
And now, here is your host, Mark Anderson.
Why is it that so many rights claimed by the political left depend on you and me paying for those rights? They demand health care. It's a human right, they say. Well, who pays for it? You and me. They demand public funding of abortions. They demand green energy. They demand wind and solar so they can pretend to be green, because they're not actually green. And who pays for it? You know the answer. You and me. Taxpayers foot the bill. It's government intervention in the marketplace. Initially, when there isn't a demand for a product from the market, they use government to make up a demand, for whatever it is they feel will make them feel like they're one step closer to utopia. Tell that to the kids forced to mine lithium so liberals can pretend to be green. So much of what the left demands depends on someone else giving it to them. As I've said before, socialism is a parasite that can only survive by feeding off the wealth created by capitalism. The Industrial Revolution, or more accurately, the First Industrial Revolution, from the 1760s to roughly 1830, saw new innovations in manufacturing processes in the West. This included new chemicals, improved means to make iron and steel, new machines, and an increasing use of water and especially steam to power those machines. This meant less cost to the consumers, more profit to the manufacturers, while creating them faster and more of them, which was not only good for everyday people, but other industries could afford and use those products in their own manufacturing. Capitalism, which boils down to selling goods or services for a profit, that you end up with more money than it costs you to make it or provide it, lifted people out of poverty by the tens of millions. Capitalism, the means to grow your wealth to the point where you could then invest in others trying to grow their wealth, was the real and lasting triumph of the First Industrial Revolution. It became the fixture in the industrialized West. Capitalism was so successful at creating and spreading wealth that for the first time, society as a whole began to question what to do with all that wealth. Why? Because for the first time in history, the majority of people had so much of their own money that they could actually and truly help others less fortunate. They began to ask not only what could be done, but began to question what should be done. The late 1800s and early 1900s then saw the second industrial revolution as manufacturers tapped into new sources of energy, electricity, natural gas, oil, and its derivatives, kerosene and gasoline. No longer did your factory have to be near a source of water power, nor did they need to rely on dangerous steam power. You could have your own generator or tap into a source of power miles and miles away thanks to electric wires. With each of these economic transitions, the new wealth being created grew exponentially. The wealth of the first industrialization was nothing compared to the Rockefellers and Carnegies in the second. More recently, we have had the digital economic transition, and there too the wealth created was exponential from the last. Instead of multimillionaires, it's now multibillionaires. And now a new economic transition lies ahead, the Green Revolution. But there's a huge difference. This time, it's the government making people wealthy as they push what the left wants because they thrive on the wealth created by others. And they don't care if they break the bank along the way. And to tap into this new transition, all you have to do is to swear fealty to it. This week, we're looking at the economic situation in the U.S., some indicators that are not good, an administration that can't keep its economic pants up because they refuse to tighten their belt, and some economic extortion. To talk about all that, I'd like to welcome back Jonathan Williams. He's co-author of Rich States, Poor States, an annual report by ALEC. That's American Legislative Exchange Council, about competition among the states and a ranking of their economic outlook. He's also the chief economist and executive vice president for policy at ALEC. Jonathan, it's great to talk to you again.
Well, it's always great to be with you, my friend. And as always, I bring you greetings from the land of make-believe here in Washington.
I keep thinking at some point that might not be true, but I see no signs that that is ever going to be not true. It's always the land of make-believe there. Gosh, scary.
It sure is. And unfortunately, if anything, Mark, it's got either more magic or it gets more laughs nowadays. But it is really a tragedy of what's going on here in Washington. Oh. There's no doubt.
Oh, it is. It's like a whole bunch of grade schoolers are suddenly in charge. So we want to talk about a lot of different things with you. But right now we're seeing a lot of economic disturbances. We've got supply chain issues, gasoline shortages caused by government intervention, inflation out of control, especially in food prices. The administration is now arresting political opposition, and you got a permissiveness or at least a tolerance of violence and crime and a big push to remove guns from law-abiding citizens. I mean, these are the kinds of problems you see in formerly free countries making the transition to full socialism. Do you ever get the feeling that we are living in the beginning stages of socialism? I mean, this is what it would look like, what we're living through right now.
Well, it's, you know, certainly dangerous times for all of us who believe in freedom and free enterprise and individual liberty and so many of those just key American principles that we were founded upon, right? And so any time that any of those are under threat, and we see it all the time, whether it's at the federal level and certain these progressive, you know, states, even with others outside of the government sector threatening individual liberty in so many cases, these are dangerous times. There's no doubt. And, you know, let's hope that the cooler heads do prevail and we follow, you know, what we know has always worked for America, and that is to put freedom first, right? And to put individuals first and to follow the ideas of decentralized power and federalism and making sure that we don't allow for government to get too big where it starts to do these kind of things that encroach upon rights. And so you do raise some interesting points, though, there, Mark, in that, you know, you talk to a lot of folks across the country and they're alarmed by the kind of rollback of even personal freedoms that we've seen over the last couple of years. There's no doubt.
Yep. You know, so much of what we're seeing really is the failure of government intervention. Governments have never and can never get economic interventions right, because if they had, gosh, socialism would actually work. But there was a really interesting article that I just came across. Germans were being warned of further food price hikes. And the article cited what others have pointed to over the last 5 months. You've got energy prices have doubled. The price of fertilizers, especially nitrogen, has quadrupled and so on. But they also said this that I found very revealing. They said that food has been sold below value in recent years in Germany, but I know elsewhere, certainly here. And prices have to go up for farmers to be able to continue to farm at all. And that was a really interesting admission, because once again, we see that government interferes with the markets and they mess up the market. And now they have to overcorrect rather than if they had just not interfered in the first place. Would you care to comment on that?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's just typical big government approach to policymaking is, you know, the federal or state or other levels of government get involved and micromanage the free market, whether it's subsidies or discriminatory taxes or regulations that stop the production of things or enhance certain others. When government starts to pick winners and losers, really, regardless, whether it's agriculture or other areas of the market, you know, obviously there's lots of unintended consequences. And so many times then government comes in and tries to, you know, solve those unintended consequences with bigger government policies, and your vicious cycle just continues, Mark, as you know well. And so that's the hallmark of government intervention and involvement is, you know, so many of the times that's, you know, maybe even well-intentioned that they get involved. But once they do, they create a lot of problems. And then you just kind of go down that very dangerous road of government getting larger and larger. And unfortunately, those of us who believe in free markets and freedom in the private sector see our freedoms encroached upon more and more.
You would think at some point governments would learn that the more they interfere, the worse off it gets. But and yet there they are with their fingers on all these different pies. But the big lie out of this administration is that they claim that they are not responsible for the huge increase in gasoline prices, that it's Putin's fault, because we were energy independent and a net exporter of oil, but Putin somehow made us stop doing all of that. So here, too, is government interfering being the problem, not the solution. Do any of Biden's claims to try to not take responsibility in gas prices, do any of them have any ring of even small truth, or is this or even a basis in reality?
Well, you know, this is you almost have to you know, look at what the first actions of this administration were. If you remember in those early days, it was to stop the Keystone XL pipeline.
Yep.
It was to stop the sale and the lease of the oil and gas permits on federal lands. Almost job number one for this administration was to do that kind of a thing. And so I think in a way they're trying to whitewash history here and having people kind of look the other way at other obviously big events that are going on and just cast blame on those. But, you know, they'd like for people to forget about what some of those very early actions were in the Biden administration that unfortunately made America weaker, made us more dependent on dangerous other foreign sources of oil. And now you see these ridiculous, you know, efforts from the Biden administration now to go talk to our, you know, adversaries in places like Venezuela or the Middle East to encourage them to give us more oil. And it's like, well, this is the most cell phone goal of all time when it comes to energy, where we could have continued to be exporter of energy like we were during the Trump administration and continue to be strong with the reliable, dependable, affordable energy here produced with hardworking men and women here in the country creating jobs here. But that was not part of their philosophy in the Biden administration. And unfortunately, now we're all paying the price every time we go fill up. You can thank the efforts, unfortunately, of the Biden administration that made America not only less safe, but, you know, made energy much less affordable and much less reliable here.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, let's take a break. Coming up, economic extortion. We'll talk about that next with Jonathan Williams from the American Legislative Exchange Council. And welcome back. We're talking today to Jonathan Williams. He's the Chief Economist and Executive Vice President for Policy at the American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC. If you'd like to find out more about them and their different policy areas, head to ALEC. That's ALEC.org, ALEC.org. And while you're online, check out richstatespoorstates.org as well. That's a ranking of the competitiveness among the states, and Oregon is just never looking good. Jonathan, you know, a large part of what is happening right now is Biden and the left's insatiable quest for an economic transition, a transition to green energy, which currently does not exist. If you live basically north of Los Angeles, it costs more energy to produce solar panels than they will ever generate in their lifetime. So they're a net energy loss. The rare earth minerals needed for much of green energy result in toxic waste. As much as 2,000 tons of toxic and radioactive waste for every 1 ton of rare earth mined and refined. The only thing truly green about green energy is the color of the toxic lakes in China where it's mined and the color of the hundreds of billions of dollars spent by American taxpayers on it. So as I've mentioned in my opener, we've had economic transitions in the past, but there's two major recent ones. One was the transition to the oil economy in the early 20th century and the transition to a digital economy. I don't recall the U.S. spending billions of tax dollars to force people to buy automobiles or force them to buy computers, or am I just remembering that wrong?
No, I think you got it spot on there, Mark, in that, you know, these kind of transitions happen with the change in, you know, markets, the change in consumer preferences as companies provide better goods and services. When Michael Dell and others back in the 90s had started to provide the personal computer, and Steve Jobs with the Apple iPhone and their products, I mean, they were products that made people's lives better off, right? I mean, right. And that they were willing to have that win-win in the free market to say, I'll give you my valuable income in exchange for this new product. And it wasn't a big government coerced transition whatsoever. And you didn't see massive subsidies or discriminatory taxes to try to say, we're going to tax your old way of doing word processing or your typewriters until you have to do it via personal computer. We didn't tax mail and they say you have to go to email, right? People did that because it made sense for them. It made sense for the overall marketplace. And so as you talk about this, you know, really government coerced area of transition that we've seen from the far left and the Green New Deal crowd like AOC here in Congress, and unfortunately it's really pervaded deep within the Biden administration, is the idea that we need to transition the economy to the so-called this green economy through government effort. Now, obviously, I think we'd all agree if we got to a place where technology improved enough and we had it made sense overall, we should be for all the above energy, right? There's nothing right. That was President Trump's approach and Larry Kudlow's approach and so many others, that the private sector innovation lead the way and let's get the best energy that makes the most sense. But on the other hand, let's make sure that big government, that oftentimes we just talked about, creates more problems than it actually solves when it comes to intervention through you know, big government efforts, let's make sure that that subsidization and that discrimination in terms of taxation to try to make this transition, that could be very, very dangerous for us going forward. So that's certainly something I think all of us are really watching with a whole lot of trepidation.
Well, in the transition to the oil economy in the early 20th century, they did not use the power of government to artificially raise the price of coal in order to make you buy gasoline. And what the Biden administration is doing by knowingly and artificially raising the price of gasoline to force people to buy electric vehicles, to me, that's basically economic extortion. So how do we fight that? Can there be lawsuits against that, against the administration, or is it only going to be solved through a new election?
Well, I think, you know, this is something that as people are, you know, new leadership coming into Washington, I think it's going to have a much different philosophy on this, potentially with even new conservative majorities in Congress after November. And I think there will be a whole lot of natural pushback politically to this effort because so many of the things that are being done right now are being done either through executive order or being done through regulation or through the agencies, such as this really probably unconstitutional effort by the Securities and Exchange Commission to go after private sector companies and force them to disclose climate and kind of efforts. And
right.
So things like that would be a huge, you know, effort to kind of bring government in. But, you know, a lot of times they're realizing they can't pass it legislatively right now, even though they have the big media apparatus on their side and so many other things in their favor. They cannot pass a Green New Deal through the legislative process. They can't pass things like carbon taxes or other things that would be anti-energy to try to do this big government transition. And so in many cases, they're resorting to things kind of below the surface. As I think you see maybe a balancing of the political powers here in Washington after November, I think you're going to see a lot of people say thanks but no thanks. We really want to have a public debate around what's best for the country and what's best for taxpayers going forward.
Well, yes to everything that you just said, but just to add to that, when you compare previous transitions to what's going on today, the government is effectively saying they're going to punish you if you don't buy what we want you to buy. But worse than that, perhaps, is that the government is choosing the winners and losers in all of this. Their political allies stand to make literally trillions of dollars. So, of course, they are more than happy to push this on everybody. Trillions, not just from the sales of things like electric vehicles and green energy and wind and solar, but also a massive expansion of the power grid. But they're also handing cash to their chosen winners through tax credits. Is it time for a serious redo of how we apply these tax credits? Because right now, they're just being handed out by the billions to their favorite industries.
Well, it's a clear example of government picking winners and losers through the tax code, which is absolutely the wrong way to go about tax policy. And it's a big government approach to try to influence people to do something in this case or to not do something with discriminatory taxes on carbon taxes or things like that. But I mean, I think you see a lot of this, you know, playing out, Mark. We've talked about it in the past around this nefarious kind of real nebulous, I think is probably a better word, concept around ESG principles, the so-called environmental and social and governance principles, mm-hmm. that really, if you ask 100 people what that means, that you get 100 different answers. You hesitate to criticize it because you really, to criticize something, you have to be able to define it first. But they're using that as a politicized weapon in order to bring really companies to their heels and to bring, you know, even individual citizens in many cases, is that we're seeing that pervade so many different areas of the private sector and government that we're getting that foisted upon us to have these kind of progressive politics placed on us to make this transition happen through innocuous sounding things like environmental, social, and governance principles.
Okay, let's go ahead and take a break. Coming up, we're going to be talking about some economic indicators. We'll do that with Jonathan Williams of Alex. Stay with us. Back, we're talking today to Jonathan Williams. He is the co-author of Rich States, Poor States, an annual report by ALEC of competition among the states and a ranking of their economic outlook. You can find out more about that by heading to richstatespoorstates.org. But he's also the chief economist and executive vice president for policy at the American Legislative Exchange Council. To find out more about that, head to alec.org. And so, Jonathan, we were talking during the break there about ESGs and also their impact on pensions. And this is really something that should be worrying people. Why don't you talk to our audience a little bit about these and the impact that these will have on pensions and corporate profits?
Yeah, it's a huge area. We could almost spend an entire show on this, Mark. But as you and I have talked about, these massive unfunded government pension liabilities mm-hmm. that only continue to grow. In fact, our new report is out just this week, came out talking about how now unfunded pension liabilities across the states exceed $8 trillion. And so this is a huge issue. But what one of the things that's making it worse is as we uncover more and more of this, is that these radical Green New Deal style politics are invading state pension systems through this innocuous sounding and really difficult to define standard of ESG, meaning that in many cases, we're seeing state pensions now to divest from their holdings in, let's say, coal or in tobacco in the past, or now all fossil fuels, however defined that might be. And so just last session, we saw the state of Maine be the first state in the country, as far as my research has shown, to be voted to totally divest all assets from fossil fuel related companies. And they're doing that over a number of years now, because it can be very difficult to actually practically execute as well. But, you know, we've seen now active legislation being talked about in California. I believe it's already passed one house of their legislature that would divest CalPERS and CalSTRS, two of the largest systems in the country, totally from fossil fuel related stocks. Imagine the downside for returns in a market such as this, where oil prices are where they're at. For these hugely underfunded pension plans to start with, and now people are putting their own political, left-wing political views ahead of what's best for the funds. And so one of the things that we've been working on quite a bit at ALEC is coming up with a series of best practices and principles to shore up state really rules, and having a rules-based approach to ensuring that if you're going to have these expensive defined benefit pension plans, you should fund them well, you should have real accounting rules around them, as we've talked about many times, and then you should make sure that these funds aren't being susceptible to people playing politics with those investment decisions, and of course hurting the long-term returns in advance of that. And so we've actually, something that we've seen is states are looking now to really pass these kind of new fiduciary rules at the state level to protect against this radical type of politics that's invading state pensions. Now, this is something that at the federal level, by the way, you know this, Mark, but a lot of people may not. The Department of Labor and Congress, through their ERISA laws that they passed in the 1970s, oversee the private sector defined benefit plans and have real rules where people actually would go to prison if they don't do the right thing governing pension systems, because they need to act as fiduciaries managing other people's hard-earned retirement dollars.
Right.
But unfortunately, at the state level, the rules are over the map. And unfortunately, as we've seen now with these efforts to divest away from particular industries or companies based on politics versus long-term rates of return, it's clear we need those type of real standards at the state level.
And in order to do that, would those have to arise from the states, or would that have to come down from the federal government to say, hey, you need to be monitoring these the same way that they do in the private areas?
Well, I think it's ideally for those of us who believe in federalism, this should arise at the state level, and the states can consider statutory language to put some real fiduciary rules in place and put some teeth on those to say, if the fiduciaries are not acting in the best interest of the retirees, there need to be some real penalties there, and people need to be held accountable, because we can't allow Enron-style accounting that, you know, got so many companies in the private sector in trouble. We can't allow that to pervade itself into the public sector plans, because we're talking about trillions of dollars here that are being used in many cases then to even bully companies to do things that they wouldn't normally do. Companies obviously should be in the business of producing good goods and services and making people's lives better by, you know, providing us those things that we want to exchange for our dollars. But when they're being, you know, really bullied with these funds, and a lot of times the public sector pension funds are part of the bullying effort to do things that may not be in the company's best interest or those of us as consumers, that's very concerning.
It is concerning, especially when you look at these corporations that they, as you say, they're supposed to be making products for profits, which returns profits to their shareholders. I mean, that's the whole point of investing in companies. Otherwise, you may as well not invest. They should all be privately owned rather than publicly owned. I think a lot of that really started with Walmart. This was back, I think, in the early 2000s. For decades, they had been pushing back against environmental funding and whatnot. But there was a court case and some kind of, I forget what exactly it was that pushed Walmart over the edge, but they finally just dumped about $100 million into environmental causes to essentially buy off all of the boycotts that were being threatened against them. And I just look at that as really opening the floodgates, because once they got into Walmart, all of these other ones became fair game.
Well, and one of the most recent iterations of this, unfortunately, was about a year ago with ExxonMobil, that you may have seen in the news. There was a big board fight around the ExxonMobil board of directors during their annual shareholder meeting, and they had these radical kind of anti-energy board candidates running for a couple of the slots. They were being supported by, unfortunately, as it finds out, many institutional investors, and many state pension systems were voting their proxy shares to support these anti-energy type candidates that wanted to go and basically have a coup on the Exxon board of directors. And unfortunately, they did win a few of those seats on the Exxon board. And then we saw a number of weeks later, I think Exxon made the announcement that one of the largest energy company in the world was going to look to be carbon neutral, I think by 2050 was their announcement after this happened. And one other thing to just kind of connect the dots on all of this, Mark, is that just recently our friends at the Texas Public Policy Foundation uncovered something that I think should be send really shockwaves across state legislators' thoughts across the country on this. And we actually, through their work, they uncovered that some of the pension systems in the state of Texas voted the shares that they have of ExxonMobil against the wishes of ExxonMobil's management and for the anti-energy type board candidates that ended up winning. And so Texas teachers' pension and other pension funds voted against Exxon and for the anti-energy candidate. So how's that? If it can happen in Texas on anti-energy issues with these pensions, it could happen anywhere.
You know, this kind of sabotage is really rather amazing when you think about it, because you don't need to do these kinds of underhanded deeds like what you described there with Mobil and Exxon if people actually wanted your products. You know, if there wasn't, if the green energy was so great and so fantastic, people would be rushing to that. But instead, they see the problems with it. And of course, they know that they're not profitable right now. Okay, let's go ahead and take a break there. Coming up, we'll be talking about some of those economic indicators. We'll be doing that with Jonathan Williams of ALEC. Stay with us. And welcome back. We're talking about economics today. We're doing that with Jonathan Williams. He is the Chief Economist and Executive Vice President for Policy at the American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC. That's a lot easier to say, ALEC.org, if you'd like to find out some more about them and encourage your legislator to join them. And so, Jonathan, in terms of these economic indicators, you know, we know our government doesn't even think twice anymore about lying with data. You got global warming and vaccines and polling data, you name it. In fact, just this week, the new press secretary cited a poll that showed great support for Joe Biden, except it was a poll from a year ago. But at any rate, if they're willing to lie about so many things, it's not a stretch to imagine that they'll lie about the economy. Are there some areas where you see this administration fudging or even outright lying in order to mislead the public about the economy?
Well, there was recently President Biden had an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal that you may have read, where it was going through and touting all of the supposed great economic triumphs that the Biden administration has had in recent months. And I had a chance to deconstruct that on a couple of different interviews and some of the work that we've been doing, because, you know, it's really a cherry picking of timeframes issue that you need to really watch on these kind of things, as you know well, in that obviously, you know, if you start your starting point as the government lockdowns that shut down the private sector and shut down the economy there during COVID and use that as your starting point, then anything's going to look good coming out of that. Sure. And so you have to be really careful about some of the sleights of hand that are used on these data and the time frame that they're used, because it makes it artificially look good. I mean, I think you look at the fundamentals of the economy overall, though, and it's very difficult to hide what's going on. It's the Biden administration is trying to put lipstick on a pig right now when it comes to the economy. And you look at the real threat that we have for the first time, really, since the Jimmy Carter era of stagflation here in the country, where, you know, we've seen this inflation be persistently high. Now we're seeing, you know, the loss of economic growth in the first quarter. It looks like maybe the second quarter will be slow growth, but maybe in the positive from what I'm seeing on the forecast right now. But there's a real threat by the end of this year. We could be in a recession with high inflation. And so that's the ultimate, you know, fear of an economist. It's been something for a couple of years I've been talking about, as something I'm most worried about is this stagflation problem. And, you know, it's real clear what needs to happen here. And it's like the Wall Street Journal recently you know, had that editorial, you know, talking about this is the George Catanza moment of President Biden on economics, is everything that you should be doing, they're doing the exact opposite.
Yes.
What we need to do is policies that enhance economic growth, that cut spending to get rid of this scenario of inflation where there's too many dollars in the economy chasing too few goods, but to also not forget about the supply side and regulatory relief like we saw during the Trump administration. We need to see more of that. We need to see tax cuts. We need to see the supply side also, because these Federal Reserve actions, Mark, are going to be very painful going forward to get rid of kind of the free money that we've seen for far too long, probably across the economy. But there's lots of less painful ways to also address that, and that's through more economic growth and more supply side efforts as well.
Well, it's definitely concerning. You've got people like the CEO of JP Morgan Chase saying there's a hurricane coming from the U.S. economy and people better brace themselves. And there are also some economic indicators in terms of the housing industry that they're showing signs of trouble there. CNBC just had an article on Wednesday. It was titled, "Mortgage Demand Falls to the Lowest Level in 22 Years Amid Rising Rates and Slowing Home Sales." And they said that there, although there was a slight uptick in terms of mortgage rates, it's pretty minor, 0.07%. The worrisome part was that applications for mortgages to purchase new homes fell 7% for the week from the previous week, but they were 21% lower than the same week 1 year ago. And there's also this, that as it says in the title, the demand for new homes hit the demand for new mortgages was the lowest in 22 years. And if that wasn't eye-opening enough, there's this little stat: refinance demand dropped 6% from the week previous, but was down 75% from a year ago. Those aren't small blips.
No, this is a huge problem that's been building. It's been a predictable problem whenever you knew that the Fed action was going to drive up rates and that historically low interest rates for mortgages were not going to be able to continue. I kind of chalk this up, though, Mark, to this is kind of there's no such thing as a free lunch 101 lesson, and that, you know, we've spent so much money, we've printed so many dollars. I mean, what recently the Fed balance sheet totaled to, what, $9 trillion. We've seen more than $30 trillion in national debt now. The bills were going to come due. It's just a question of when. And this is the iteration, unfortunately, now that people are having to face. And, you know, you combine the higher mortgage rates now as a result of this, you know, with the higher values that we've seen just building all across the country. And it really comes forward with the toxic combination that was really pricing many, many people out of various housing markets across the country. And I think threatens especially the areas that have been, you know, most high growth recently, really threatens a potential bubble burst in a lot of the at least markets across the country that we've seen so much growth in recently.
Yeah, it's very worrisome. You know, no one is cheering for a lower economy, but we would definitely cheer if those in charge of this economy were voted out. Everyone stay with us. We're going to take a break here. We'll be back with Jonathan Williams of ALEC. And we're back with Jonathan Williams. He is the Chief Economist and Executive Vice President for Policy at the American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC, ALEC.org, if you want to go find out more. And Jonathan, you guys actually have, it looks like, some new programs there, not just economics. You've got the Education Task Force and some other ones. So are those new, or have we just had tunnel vision this whole time focusing on your economic policies and we just failed to notice these other task force?
No, we have a robust list of 10 different policy task forces, and we have our centers, which are our internal think tanks for state legislators on basically any issue that a state would be considering outside of maybe social type issues that we let other groups take the lead on. But, you know, this is, you know, we've seen, as you mentioned, education, a huge area that ALEC has been, I think, influential over the years, starting with kind of the school choice movement as it kicked off in the 1990s, and working on charter schools and working on schools of choice and working at really all of the above to give parents and students more educational options. And obviously, over the last couple of years, as more parents looked over the shoulders of their children and were very concerned about perhaps some of the things they were being taught or some of the ways they were being taught. We've seen a real revolution on these type of thoughts to say, maybe we should empower parents and empower kids more and not fund bureaucracies and not fund buildings or institutions. Let's fund the families and let's fund the kids. Mm. And so it's been really exciting to see so many states kind of pick up the ball and run with it on those type of issues and really enhance economic freedom or individual freedom in the case of school choice.
Well, absolutely. In fact, that's kind of the push right now that's happening here in Oregon. Mark Thielman, who was a candidate for governor, and he is back now into the education area, and he is the chief petitioner for two ballot initiatives to get school choice on the ballot here in Oregon. And that funding would follow the students. Parents could use those funds for education, but just on any school they want, or even just homeschool with that. And so is that some of the types of things that your education task force has been focused on?
Yes, absolutely. That's a huge area in terms of our education savings account effort on educating on those issues. We have a great piece of model legislation on that. We've been working with state leaders such as our good friend Senator Patricia Rucker from West Virginia, who just last year passed probably the most universal comprehensive school choice effort in the country with the Hope Scholarship program that she was a sponsor of. And so we've seen just radical change happening like that across the country. And of course, the things that our education task force does as well is looks for real transparency when it comes to curriculum across the country to give parents a better understanding of what's going on. Because, I mean, as you saw here, the reason we have Governor Glenn Youngkin in Virginia and not former Governor Terry McAuliffe is he said out loud what he's probably thought for a long time. You remember that infamous statement that probably did cost him the election as he was pandering to the teachers union, where he said, you know, parents shouldn't have a good deal of control or involvement in their kids' education or what they learn. Yeah. And, you know, I think people just bristle at that. And we're seeing so much, I think, healthy pushback on that big government knows best mentality in education.
Well, as I said, that's an effort right now to get this on the ballot so that these education dollars would be pegged to the student rather than to the school systems. What have been some of the best ways to get those types of initiatives passed that you've seen in these other states? What are some things that those that are trying to get that on the ballot here ought to be focusing on to convince people to vote for that?
Well, I mean, I think, if I put that hat on, I would say, you know, they need to talk to the successful, you know, states like West Virginia and Senator Rucker, and, you know, hearing her story as actually an immigrant from Venezuela who became then a conservative Republican state senator from West Virginia and led that effort. I mean, those kind of stories are really inspiring, but it's really, you know, looking at the cost, looking at the quality, you know, looking overall at just kind of the outcomes being just so poor in many cases across the country and seeing what can be done that doesn't divert, you know, money away necessarily from education, but gives families that option and choice. And, you know, we're seeing governors take the lead on this in many cases. Governor Doug Ducey, actually, in Arizona, was using it. You may have seen this, Mark, got into a little trouble with the Biden administration that he was using some of the federal funds from the ARPA plan to say if a parent doesn't like what's going on in their local school district, whether it was mask mandate or anti-mask mandate or, you know, whatever the policy was, vaccine mandate or whatever it was, that then parents could take and apply to use some of those funds to then have a school of their choice opportunity or homeschool opportunity to buy curriculum, let's say, for their kids. And Janet Yellen and the Biden administration quickly tried to come in and bully Governor Ducey to not do that kind of thing. But we're seeing efforts, whether it's governors or state legislators across the country, and real breakthroughs on school choice that we haven't seen in many, many years. So I'm very optimistic in this area. And I think that effort will continue writ large.
Was Ducey successful in pushing back against that? Was he able to keep those dollars going to the parents and letting them make the choice?
Well, I think that it's still being litigated, and I think they had some initial positive court decisions there, if I'm not mistaken. But, you know, that would obviously be something that all of us warned about. When you take these federal dollars, be very careful, because if the federal government, who's in charge of Washington at the time, comes in and doesn't like what you're doing with them, they can make your life very difficult. And in the case of, I think, what was being threatened against Arizona in this case, was it wasn't that the federal government was just going to come back and claw back the federal dollars for this program. I think they were threatening to claw back a huge percentage of the total ARPA funds that went to the state of Arizona. So be careful what we wish for. Right. These federal bailout of states are very dangerous for all of us who believe in state autonomy, clearly.
Right. Well, how horrible was it that the Biden administration is threatening to take lunch money away from schools if schools don't implement their radical transgender and all the rest policies? I mean, that's just horrific.
Well, just another reason why, you know, regardless of the issue, another reason why we should empower parents and empower mm-hmm. decision-making mm-hmm. happening at the local level versus some far-off bureaucrat in Washington. I mean, was it that many years ago the official Republican Party platform was to get rid of the Department of Education and under Ronald Reagan, right? And, of course, we've seen that drift a little bit, and unfortunately, I think we probably do need to get back to the idea yes. of locally funded and even better funding following families and kids,
yep.
right?
Yep, things have not improved ever since they put that education department in. All right, let's go and take a break. We'll wrap things up with Jonathan Williams of ALEC. You can't fix stupid, but you can fix your state. Stay with us. And welcome back in our final segment now on the iSpy Radio Show. We're talking with Jonathan Williams. He is co-author of Rich States, Poor States. It's an annual report by ALEC of competition among the states and their ranking of economic outlooks. And you can head to richstatespoorstates.org to get this year's copy of that. Find out how Oregon is doing. So, Jonathan, Republicans this year in Oregon have a real chance to take the governor's office if two things happen. They get out and vote. And they stay home and vote for Christine Drazen, the Republican candidate, rather than falling for the hype and voting for Betsy Johnson. Let her split the Democrats and Republicans can actually win this. So have you guys there at the American Legislative Exchange Council, have you guys had many discussions with Christine Drazen?
Well, no, we don't get involved in politics, but I have followed as a state legislator, as she has served, of course, as Republican leader there, followed the caucus and some of the legislative politics in both the Republican Democrat side of things, but don't know her personally, no. Mm.
So looking at what's happening here in Oregon, because as I said, you're the co-author of Rich States, Poor States, what would you urge her to do for her, you know, to really beef up her economic platform? What issues should she be running on here in Oregon?
Well, I mean, the issues, I think, for any candidate running in Oregon right now would be, you know, how do you turn down and really turn around from this long-term slide in economic competitiveness that Oregon has seen? Well, really, the only inbound, you know, migration that you're seeing and the inbound amount of capital that you're seeing into Oregon, the vast majority of that coming from California, just because it's even higher tax in Oregon yet at this point. And so how do you reverse the slide? How do you make sure that, you know, Oregon starts to become more competitive like we're seeing in states all across the country who are cutting taxes and reducing regulation and growing private sector jobs? So I think, you know, it's really a target-rich environment, unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on how you look at it, glass half full, glass half empty, Mark, in that when you look at rich states, poor states, and how, you know, the 15 factors that we look at and how we get our ranking with Oregon coming in 41st with the bottom 10 once again, is some of the highest income taxes in the country. Obviously not a right-to-work state, a state that still has a death tax. I mean, these are some key attributes of that really divide the successful states, the rich states, versus the unsuccessful or poor states across the country. And now doing this for 15 years and seeing really the relative growth and lack of growth across the country in various states, depending on what kind of policies that they choose, you know, it's very clear that the states that are growth states today, the states that are, you know, the in-migration hotspots, the states that are creating the most jobs, are the states that follow a lower tax, light regulatory, and good overall economic policy environment overall. And so that would be my advice to anyone running in Oregon is to, you know, how do you make sure that you get out of the bottom 10, you stop digging the hole deeper when right. it comes to economic competitiveness, and at least show that Oregon once again would be open for job creation and economic growth.
Well, we have been slowly sneaking in additional taxes. We had the corporate activity tax, which has bitten some people in the butt here recently. Last time we talked with you, the pharmacies that had been running in Bi-Mart, they had to close specifically because of that corporate activity tax. And then they've also been slipping in some sales tax here and there on things like hotel room stays and also car sales as well. But you have been jetting around the country, basically keeping the airline industry afloat single-handedly. You've seen some positive legislative wins there in some other states. Talk to us about what other states are doing.
Well, it's been a very successful year for taxpayers in many states across the country. In fact, we've seen historic tax cuts and tax reform this year. Mark, a quick history lesson in that states have been taxing income for over 110 years now. And we saw a grand total over 110 years of four states that went from progressive systems that penalize work, savings, and investment, obviously, to flat taxes. Four states over 110 years. But in the last couple of months, we've actually seen four new states this year that have gone online with flat taxes that moved away from progressive anti-growth tax systems into flat taxes, such as Iowa, Mississippi, Georgia, and Arizona. So it's been an incredible flat tax revolution of these states not only becoming flat tax states, but in many cases, substantially reducing the tax burden at the same time, such as Iowa, where Governor Kim Reynolds gave the response to President Biden's State of the Union back in March, where just a couple of hours earlier, she had signed that into law that will reduce the Iowa tax rate on individuals from over 8% to below 4%. So cutting the tax rates in half. And really, states are trying to do their best to say, we might have a messed up big government scenario happening in Washington, D.C. right now, but we're going to use the levers of power that we have at the state level to make our states more competitive and to help our taxpayers make it through this very challenging economic scenario.
Little islands of sanity. So you talk to legislators from all across the nation, state, local, and federal. What are you hearing back from them? Are they deeply concerned about the direction our country is headed, or just no more so than usual?
Well, I think there's a lot of concern at the federal level of what's going on right now, that there needs to be a course correction, that we're staring down this threat of stagflation for the first time in 40-plus years. And I think they're very concerned, state legislators are, by and large, of this continued attack on the idea of federalism and state autonomy. It seems that almost everything, the common theme of the big proposals coming out of Washington over the last year and a half have been really aimed at how do we federalize more things instead of how do we allow states to govern themselves and how do we protect individual rights. And that's, of course, the real definition of federalism under the 10th Amendment to the Constitution. And so I think state legislators are very nervous about the ideas that would centralize more power in the hands of the federal government, which, of course, proves time and time again that it's inept. More recently when it comes to anything economic policy related.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Jonathan, thank you so much for your time. It's been great as always.
Great to join you, my friend.
There was a sign in Bill Clinton's Oval Office, "Keep away from the interns, Bill." But next to that was one somewhat more famous, "It's the economy, stupid." Now, with Biden in the Oval Office, it's more like, "It's the government, stupid." Because instead of focusing on growing the economy, it's about growing the government at all costs. As I said, you are living in the transition stages of a switch from capitalism to socialism. Higher food prices, higher energy prices, exploding inflation, high crime, and an effort to remove guns from law-abiding citizens. This is what the entry to socialism looks like. To see how it ends up, look at Venezuela. The only way to change it is to change who's in office. Because as we say every week, the best information does you no good if you don't use it. Reagan, what do you think?
I do not believe in a fate that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show.